welcome to the Obesity Panacea podcast. I am Travis Saunders, and today joining me on the podcast is Dr. Zach Ferraro. So, Zach, welcome, and do you want to sort of tell people who you are and what it is that you do?
Great. Well, thanks a lot, Travis, for having me. Happy to be doing a podcast for a great blog.
Great.
So, currently, I'm a clinical research associate, the Division of Maternal Fetal Medicine at the Ottawa Hospital, and a part-time professor in human kinetics at the University of Ottawa.
And so in case people don't know, because you did a previous podcast several years ago, and didn't you? I think you did.
Yes, we did.
Yeah, and you've done a couple guest posts on the blog. So for people who don't know Zach, we've also been lab mates for while we were doing our PhDs, which mine ended just recently, and Zach's ended not too long ago. So we were lab mates for several years in Ottawa. So Zach is sort of like the go-to person for exercise and pregnancy. I would say, I mean, I don't know your area that much, but I would say that you and Christy are like the go-to people for exercise and pregnancy in Canada. Now, I'm not sure if you would say that because you're probably too humble to say that, but that is what I would say. Certainly you guys seem to be sort of on the cutting edge in terms of exercise and pregnancy in Canada, at least. That seems pretty fair, eh?
Yeah, there's our group, but there's also, to give credit where it's due, there's been a lot of incredible work coming out the exercise and pregnancy lab out of Western, Michelle Matola's group, and she's produced a lot of the information that that I may talk about today, and as well the design, the ParMedX for pregnancy. So yeah, kudos to the Western group there. But I'll be happy to discuss what we've got going on in Ottawa.
Cool. Well, yeah. So why don't you talk a bit to start about some of the research you did at your PhD, which was like, I think I've mentioned this on the blog before. You had the most ridiculously broad PhD I've ever seen. You had like molecular stuff on one end, where you're in the lab doing like wet lab stuff, and then you had like epidemiological stuff on the other end. But why don't you talk a little bit about sort of the key findings from your PhD?
Cool. So the PhD dissertation was looking at potential modifiers and contributors to fetal growth during pregnancy. And since we were, Travis and I, members of the Healthy Active Living and Obesity Research Group, one of the contributors was looking at maternal obesity and how obesity and then the independent effects of excessive weight gain altered fetal growth. But then I became fascinated with some of the literature that was suggesting that physical activity during pregnancy can both have positive and negative effects on fetal growth. So that's what I considered one of the potential modifiers. So during the PhD, I looked at the effects of maternal obesity on fetal overgrowth, which is large for gestational age babies, but also the independent effect of excessive gestational weight gain. So that means independent of where you start your pregnancy, whether underweight, normal weight, or obese, if you exceed the recommendations for healthy pregnancy weight gain, seeing how that affected your predisposition for having a big baby, large for gestational age neonate. And so to get at that answer, we did look at large data sets in the Ottawa and Kingston birth cohort. And then, as Travis mentioned, I followed that up looking at some molecular markers of fetal growth in pregnancy, primarily the insulin-like growth factor axis, and how that may relate to maternal obesity and excessive weight gain.
And so if I remember correctly, the simpler of the study, the epidemiological study, your finding was basically that, so regardless of where you start, the more weight you gain during pregnancy, the more likely you are to have a large baby. That's basically the take-home message from the first study?
Yeah, the take-home message is if you exceeded the guidelines, you're very likely to have a large baby.
And how large were some of the babies on the larger end of the spectrum in that study?
So in that study,
I'm putting you on the spot. That's one of those questions that I hate to get about my own study. It's like a simple question, but it's a hard one. But sorry, go ahead.
So it all depends on when they were born, because we categorize them as a birth weight centile for gestational age, and that's different for both male and female babies. But it's safe to say that some of them were, if you're considered large for gestational age, you're considered macrosomic, so you're at least over 4 kilos or 4,000 grams. So,
and so what's that in? So 4 kilos and pounds, that's like 9 pounds?
Yeah, just approaching 9 pounds. And of course, there was some over 10 kilos, or sorry, over 10 pounds.
10 kilos, that'd be a hefty baby.
But surprisingly enough, there's been a baby or two born over 10 kilos, and they are the heaviest born on Earth.
And we've talked about this before, and those were born by C-section, those the largest babies to be born, correct?
Yes.
Yes, okay. Which makes sense, quite frankly.
So it's essentially like large for gestational age. I mean, to really simplify it, it is essentially it's looking at centiles, and just like we in the pediatric population, it's looking at greater than or equal to the 90th centile for your age.
Okay. So it's like a growth curve, and if you're above the curve, you're considered sort of an overweight or obese baby. But you don't really use those terms for babies, do you?
No. They're softer at that stage.
Right. And so can you just talk for a second about how, because I think it's confusing a lot of the time. So babies that are born that are very large are more likely to be obese down the road. But babies that are born skinny are also at increased risk of being obese down the road, right? Like it's like a U-shaped curve, is that right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's really a J-shaped curve because at the lower end you can only be born so light without having failure to thrive.
Oh, okay.
So when they're born light, many obesity aficionados on your blog will be familiar with adiposity rebound and catch-up growth. And so that's where more the thrifty phenotype hypothesis fits in, where babies who are born smaller, the theory goes that they're somewhat deprived in one way or another or stressed in utero, and then when they enter an environment of plenty and are fed, whether force-fed through the bottle or introduced to solids too quickly or just by nature of our environment in which we live, consume calories too many calories too quickly as they grow. Their body preferentially stores and they rapidly gain weight and grow at an accelerated trajectory. But at the flip side, when you're born large for gestational age, you're not really deprived in utero. You're almost saturated with energy in utero. And it essentially establishes thresholds for satiety and fullness and to simplify things, really. And then when you are born large, you just carry and track that excess weight throughout life. So if you're born at the 90th percentile, you're more likely to be at the 90th percentile as a teen and therefore as an adult, and that's what we call the intergenerational cycle. So while both spectrums of birth weight contribute to obesity, and the smaller babies definitely more severe in terms of catch-up growth, the larger babies, by sheer magnitude of babies born large and women exceeding the guidelines and pregnancy complicated by obesity, that's why we decided to focus on the large baby phenomenon, because although less severe per unit, the magnitude of the problem is much greater.
So there are a lot more babies being born too large than there are babies being born too small.
Yeah, and just to put it in perspective, less than, depending on which birth cohort you look at, but it's safe to say less than 10% are born small for gestational age or intrauterine growth restricted.
Yeah.
Where you're looking at 20 to 25 and up percent of babies being born macrosomic or large for gestational age, depending on which birth cohort you look at.
Okay. And I assume that's probably increased over time?
It appears to be increasing over time. We appear to be shifting the birth weight distribution to the heavier neonates, the heavier babies, taking away from the healthy appropriate for gestational age and increasing the large babies without having any effect on the smaller babies.
Oh, really? Oh, that's interesting. And I guess it's probably very different risk factors that put a baby at risk for being small for gestational age, I assume. Is that sort of why that's not changing?
Yeah, absolutely. That historically, there was things that we're not so concerned about in North America now, and I would even say in emerging third world countries, they're not as concerned about, for example, you know, nutrient deprivation. Although still very important issue in places in Africa and developing nations, in North America, that's not as problematic.
And so you mentioned the second part of your thesis, looking at insulin-like growth factor. So is that sort of like how you're talking about, you know, the children for mothers who exceed the guidelines for weight gain, they're exposed to these factors that lead them to be larger, and insulin-like growth factor is one of them? Is that?
It's, correct? Yeah, well, you know what? It was actually counter to my original hypothesis. And when I was sitting with my committee and discussing the results, what we concluded was it wasn't an excess of growth promoting factor per se, but it was an decreased inhibitory factor. So they weren't.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So,
not that there was too much gas, but there wasn't enough brake.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it.
Cool. And so it wasn't insulin-like growth factor then? That's what you're saying?
It was insulin-like growth factor, but if insulin-like growth factor is the gas and the binding proteins that bind to it and inhibit its function are the brake, there was dysfunctional binding proteins with mothers with obesity.
Gotcha. Okay. Man, that gets complicated in a hurry, the stuff you worked on. I'm always impressed by your level of knowledge of these things, because it's so much more complicated than the stuff that I had to learn for my thesis defense. I'm always impressed by how you mastered all that stuff.
Well, thank you. Now, lots of work.
So I should tell anyone who's listening that the reason, the impetus for this podcast, not just that obviously I wanted to have you on anyways, but also the fact that my wife Dawn is 4.5 months pregnant, and so she was really curious. Actually, before we even were telling anyone, Zach, we're like, okay, we got to get some questions for Zach, because we had I feel like I probably know more than the average person about exercise and pregnancy, just because of hanging out with you for the past 3 or 4 years. But I still know.
You make it sound like our conversations are so great.
Well, then we do. We've spent a lot of time talking about placentas, to be fair. I guess Dawn was going to be on the podcast, as I explained to Zach earlier, and because she's pregnant and quite active and still working, she's really tired, so she gave me a list of questions to ask Zach so that she could go to bed early. So I guess just sort of basic questions, Zach, what are the sort of recommendations for exercise during pregnancy for women?
Okay, so first, before I say that, I would like to just make this that I am not a medical doctor, and that this is not to be taken as medical advice, but purely educational.
Yes, of course. Thank you for that, Zach. Yes, that's important to mention.
Most of the things I'll talk about today actually came out of the Joint Society of Obstetrics and Gynecology Canada and Canadian Society for Exercise Physiology Clinical Practice Guideline. And the recommendations according to that guideline are for previously sedentary women who was not active prior to becoming pregnant and feels that this teachable moment is something that they really want to embrace, that 3 times per week of low to moderate activity starting at 15 minutes gradually working their way up to 30-minute sessions would be sufficient. And that activity can be anything from swimming, walking, cycling, really low-impact aerobics, and very low-intensity strength training. However, for the flip side, which would definitely apply to your lovely wife, the more active woman, the guidelines suggest that 4 days per week would be sufficient, and they can work at an intensity, because they're much more conditioned to the activity, a moderate to vigorous level, for about 30 or more minutes per session, but the same type, low impact aerobics and strength and conditioning, avoiding the supine position after 20 weeks.
So is there any reason, so a lot of the women that Dawn and I hang out with, so we're distance runners, a lot of our friends are distance runners, so a lot of them are still very active. We know women that have won races well into the pregnancy. Is there any reason why you couldn't train just as hard while you're pregnant as you did before, assuming that you still felt okay doing it?
There is some rationale, but interestingly enough, there's not a lot of evidence on the topic for the population you're referring to, like more of the elite athlete than the very, very conditioned person. There's only one study. Or 2 studies to date have looked at elite athletes, and there is evidence to suggest that when elite athletes, Olympic hopefuls, so contenders for the games, were working at greater than or equal to 90% of their VO2 max, that it was impeding blood flow, placental blood flow and uterine artery blood flow.
like permanently or just like transiently, like while they were exercising, and then it bounced back up afterwards?
Exactly, transiently while they were exercising, but that was enough cause for concern for the investigators to immediately terminate that stage of exercise. But the good news is, like you mentioned, they did rebound immediately within 2 to 3 minutes of stopping that high intensity exercise. So there is if the woman feels capable and able and motivated to engage in such high levels of activity, there are inherent risks, and that's why they make those recommendations to try and not make performance gains while pregnant, but maintain general fitness and follow the appropriate healthy weight gain for pregnancy. So then you can maintain your cardiovascular, your fitness, your strength, deliver, and then re-enter the game postpartum with very little excess weight gain and still being in a fairly conditioned state.
Right. Okay. And it's interesting because, you know, as we've been going to the doctor and these different sessions, it seems like the bias is always to err on the side of, like, doing less. And it was interesting because Tom and I were talking about it at supper. And so, well, like, I wonder what, like, is there any research that says you have to do less, or just, you know, everyone just sort of a little bit nervous and just would prefer you do less just to be on the safe side?
And that's after reviewing so much of the literature and looking more at just posts online and forums, that definitely seems to be the consensus, and it is erring on the side of caution for that, especially given that the population today, most aren't capable of exercising or they don't feel the desire to exercise at 90% of their VO2 for an extended period of time.
But I mean, that's hard to do. Like, when I think of, like, because we were talking about, like, you know, what you could do, and so Dom's trying to be active, obviously, and is one of the most active people I know, but even now, she has no interest in exercising at 90% VO2 max. It's more like, you know, 60-70%, and just wants to make sure that's okay.
Exactly.
And so that type of thing then, which seems like sort of the highest intensity that would be reasonable for most people, is still probably fine then.
Exactly. And what they use is the surrogate measures that us physiologists know so well is the TOC test.
The TOC
test, and that's written into the guidelines, the CSEP SOGC guidelines, as a surrogate measure of intensity. And so for any CSEP CEP or CPT or personal trainer or, you know, physician, midwife, obstetrician who reads that, they can make recommendations saying if you can't hold a conversation and you can't pass the TOC test, then maybe you just need to tone it down ever so slightly. So that would be an appropriate level of intensity that's not compromising cord blood flow, urinary blood flow, and therefore the delivery of oxygen and nutrients to the baby.
Okay. And this is something that we were talking about too, because Dawn's been hard, just, you know, being pregnant, it's pretty tiring, I take it from her experience. It seems quite tiring, quite physically demanding, and working obviously as well at times. And so, like, she's still, you know, exercising 3, 4, 5 days a week. But it's, you know, we're both making a conscious effort to make sure that she's able to get out and exercise. So it must be really, really hard for someone who's not active to begin with, because it doesn't seem like it would be a very pleasant time to become physically active.
No, and it doesn't. And obviously, God bless those who want to engage and who do engage. And since we'll never have the opportunity,
right,
all we can do be is the, you know, the crowd support in the corner. But most who have never engaged in activity and then become pregnant and view it as a teachable moment to improve their health and that of their child tend to prefer walking. And it is the most preferred and the most highly cited modality of physical activity in pregnancy. And a lot of great work from Margie Davenport and Michelle Mottola has shown that even mild walking can improve insulin sensitivity. So it doesn't have to be anything big. Some is better than none, especially during this critical period of both maternal and fetal body weight control.
And now is cycling, so we're coming out of winter here in Canada, so we were running a lot early on. And then we did a lot of cross-country skiing, which is good because there wasn't any pounding, which the pounding of running has sort of started to become unpleasant for Don. But We also learned to speed skate, but she sort of self-selected out of that after a little while, which is probably a good call. But sort of moving to the summer, we do a lot of cycling, and cycling seems like it could be unpleasant when pregnant, or is it something that's typically, like, do pregnant women tend to have problems with cycling, or is it something that tends to be okay?
Well, the literature says that cycling is one of those activities that may be preferred as a non-weight-bearing activity, but it will just require adjustments to the bicycle.
Right. And so what would those be? Because we were sort of assuming, just looking at our road bikes versus our sort of commuter bikes, thinking that probably a more upright posture and sort of a bigger seat would probably be things that would be better, as opposed to, you know, a racing saddle and hunched over on a road bike?
Yeah, I mean, no, there's no, I haven't come across any studies that look at this specifically. It'd be my cycling background and just common sense that would prevail here. But yes, I feel that it would be user preference, right? And if a woman felt comfortable in that traditional hunched over position, probably unlikely, but there's
nothing, that's what we're thinking. Yeah.
There's nothing to suggest that it's harmful per se. So I think just whatever makes the activity most enjoyable at that point would probably be the best. So raising the handlebars slightly and not being in full out recumbent or anything like that. But
right, no, and that makes sense. And so have you found, how good are doctors? Could we, like, you know, Don is specifically asking questions, and we're very curious about this stuff. So when we go to the doctor, it's, you know, we ask about these things. But how many doctors would bring these things up with their pregnant patients, like unprompted, about being physically active and giving them information about the guidelines or that sort of thing? Has anyone done any studies to look at that sort of thing?
They have, and we actually did a study just looking at information channels and amount of physical activity and healthy eating during pregnancy, and it may not be representative to the population of obstetric or of prenatal care providers together. In our particular study, we found that while there was high competency in the area, the women were not reporting that the physicians were making the recommendations, and they were more or less focusing on multivitamin supplementation. But since I started working in the area, it's quite obvious that maternity care providers have so much to do in so little time, and
yeah.
It seems that physical activity and pregnancy-specific dietary recommendations fall to the wayside if there's more pressing clinical issues that need to be addressed. So.
Yeah.
They're kind of in a difficult place. Our work suggests that the conversations are not being had, and that there's definitely a gap, and there's definitely a disconnect between what women report receiving and what physicians and clinicians report delivering. But taking into account the limited amount of time that physicians have during the prenatal visits and the many different checklists they have to go through, I somewhat understand why. So that's why I feel that there's this really urgent need for allied providers in this area to address some of these concerns and have a more thorough conversation during the prenatal period.
And that makes a lot of sense. And it's funny because, you know, when we've had these questions, it's funny because, you know, when we think, oh, we should talk to a dietitian, but then it's, oh, but we want to speak to a dietitian who knows pregnancy. And that's easy enough to find, but to find a physiotherapist or a personal trainer who knows much about pregnancy, like, you're literally the only personal trainer I know who knows anything about pregnancy. aside from female personal trainers who have gone through it, I guess, would be the only exception to that. But you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like, it doesn't seem like something that's really covered at all in undergrad, aside from if you have a pregnant patient, you should have her fill out the ParMed X, or the pregnancy ParMed X, or whatever it's called, is basically all I remember about learning about, you know, pregnant women and exercise.
It's kind of an untapped market in terms of allied professionals, trainers, and physiologists who have a bit of expertise on the topic.
Yeah, definitely. It certainly seems that way.
No, it doesn't. I saw that, and when I was trying to find anecdotal information to just get a feel for what was going on when I was immersing myself in this area during my PhD, I couldn't really find anyone either. So this year, when I taught my course, I intentionally put in 1 week of material bill worth of essentially pregnancy and how that relates to fitness training principles, and healthy weight management. And was trying to encourage a class of human kinetics students, because this was a prerequisite course for the CPT and CEP exam, that they may want to pursue something on physical activity and pregnancy, or nutrition and pregnancy, because there's really nothing out there. So to make themselves competitive in a saturated market, this may set them apart.
And so we've been talking about sort of physical activity, because that's obviously our interest. What are the weight gain guidelines? Because you mentioned those a couple times. So what are the recommended, or what is the recommended weight gain for a typical pregnancy?
Okay, so it all depends on where you start your pregnancy. And the general rule is that the lighter you are, the more weight you're allowed to gain. And the heavier you are, the more conservative the range is. So, for example, a normal weight woman, according to BMI, pre-pregnancy BMI, is supposed to gain anywhere between 11.5 and 16 kilos. So that's about 25 to 35 pounds throughout their entire pregnancy.
Okay.
And that breaks down to about, 0.3 kilos a week to 0.6 pounds per week in the second and third trimester. Assuming that they gain, anywhere between 0.5 and 2 kilos in the first trimester altogether.
Okay.
However,
yeah.
An obese woman or a woman with obesity has a more narrow range, and they should gain between 5 and 9 kilos and 11 and 20 pounds per their term. So that's about 0.5 pounds per
week. And so for a woman who's starting out, when she becomes pregnant, is already obese, then, or has obesity, then the weight she's gaining is basically just enough to account for the baby, and I'm assuming the placenta and the amniotic fluid and that sort of thing, and not a whole lot of actual adiposity gain, I'm assuming?
That's right. So that's where the difference would definitely be made up. So if any of your listeners want specific information on that, they can see the Health Canada website for gestational weight gain guidelines, or they can see the Institute of Medicine Gestational Weight Gain Guidelines 2009 report, and those are Health Canada and the IOM. They share the same guidelines. Health Canada adopted them shortly after the IOM produced them.
Okay, and then now I'm just curious. I'm not sure if you know the answer to this, but oftentimes in any given situation, you'll find that people, the most obese individuals in a population, are the ones who are also susceptible, it seems, to most rapid weight gain when you expose them to something. So for example, if you take kids with obesity and have them watch a food ad on TV, they're much more likely to overeat following that ad than a lean child would be. And I'm wondering then, a woman with obesity, when she becomes pregnant, is she more likely to gain excessive amounts, even just in absolute terms, than, say, a woman who starts out at a normal weight? Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. And so actually the generalization from the EPI studies suggests that women with obesity actually gain less in terms of absolute amount of weight.
Oh, but, okay. So that's actually what you would hope. So that's good, right?
It's good, yeah. But the only reason they're exceeding is because of the narrower range of the guideline.
Okay, so they're not gaining as much as other women, but they're still gaining more than necessarily would be ideal.
That's exactly it, and it's there are a couple of exceptions to the rule, but for the most part, that's the case. So it's not people with obesity that are gaining the absolute greatest amount of weight at all.
And so you touched on it a bit when you talked about, underweight versus overweight babies. But what is it? So is it sort of like if a person gains weight, like an adult gains weight, and then loses that weight, we talk about how their set point has gone up, so they're always going to require more food to feel full after a meal and that sort of thing. And is that sort of the idea of what happens with a baby whose mother gains excessive amounts of weight during pregnancy, that the baby is sort of exposed to more nutrients in the womb, and so therefore they're always going to require more food to sort of feel that same level of hunger compared to someone who's exposed to less nutrients in the womb? Is that sort of the thinking?
That is absolutely the thinking. It's the established thresholds and then how the orexigenic and anorexigenic pathways in the brain regulate energy balance. So, I mean, this right now, there's it's a little bit anecdotal, and I'm probably overstretching the true findings, but in general terms, it's exactly what you're saying. It just establishes your starting point, your thresholds for the rest of your life, and then they call that fetal plasticity, and so really it's the most malleable time between conception and around 2 years of age, and then after that, the thresholds established during the prenatal period kind of drive what happens the rest of life.
And so, have there been any studies, I know there's some sort of ongoing, but have there been any studies that are done that have actually found that, okay, if you randomize a woman to exercise versus non-exercise, that she will come out with, that her baby will be born healthier or have better outcomes, or the pregnancy will progress more smoothly compared to a woman who's less active? Like, not just in terms of, you know, observational studies, but actual intervention studies.
Yeah, there's been a handful of intervention studies on the topic, and there's been actually just enough intervention studies to produce some meta-analysis and systematic reviews.
Oh, cool.
And so when they look at the effect of a physical activity intervention alone, the overall results do favor the intervention. However, the findings within each study are quite mixed because of the heterogeneity of the intervention. But overall, the physical activity intervention seems to help women meet the recommended guidelines for physical activity and also helps women deliver at a healthy, appropriate size neonate for gestational age.
Okay. And I assume that having a large for gestational age baby, is there more likely to have some sort of complications during the birth process compared to a normal for gestational age weight baby?
Yeah, absolutely. So for one, if it's delivered naturally, then there's risks of tearing, but there's also risks if delivered by C-section. So the bigger the baby, the more opportunity for error. And if there's complications during pregnancy related to size at birth, absolutely, for sure.
Okay, and since you mentioned C-section, have you seen the studies about, well, actually, I think we've talked about it briefly in the past, but the studies of, that found that babies that were born via C-section were more likely to become overweight or obese compared to children that were born through vaginal birth?
I have seen that, yes, I have seen that. Those studies are very, it's an interesting study.
And so what's the thinking there on, like, what could explain that? Like, is there an actual mechanism that would make sense?
The mechanism that makes most sense to me would be with respect to the natural flora that are acquired when delivered vaginally opposed to through C-section.
And so there's actually, like, so a child actually, like, picks up that much gut flora during the birth process? Like, it doesn't seem like there would be that much that you could pick up during, like, it doesn't seem like that long, but I guess it was probably the most man thing that I could say during this podcast. but you know what I mean? Like, so, do they know that is the case, at least, that the gut flora is different between those two groups of kids?
No, they definitely do not. And it's very speculative based on the results of this observational study. So at this point, the jury is still out as to why. And I know you and I in the lab back when one of the first studies came out, we were trying to ponder, like, how could this be? But in this particular study, one thing they didn't control for was gestational weight gain.
Oh, that seems like a huge thing to not control for.
Yeah, and it does. So whether, you know, at the very least, controlling for absolute weight gain, and then at the very, you know, if you're very aware of the area, you should be controlling for the rate of weight gain throughout pregnancy. So yeah, that study failed to control for that. So at this point, I still need some convincing. But interestingly, it's a hypothesis generating piece, that's for sure.
Yeah, no, and it seems like since that came out, it seems like there have been more and more studies sort of supporting the idea that gut flora in general has something to do with obesity. So it seems like at least the mechanism itself, whether or not there's a difference between the two types of birth in terms of weight down the road, but it seems like the mechanism itself of gut flora having an impact on obesity does seem to sort of be getting some support as teams the past few years.
No, absolutely, DFS.
And so, a couple more questions. One, just because it's my own area, is there much going on with sedentary behavior and pregnancy or babies?
There is actually very little on the topic, and the most information I've seen to date on sedentary behavior is some of the more recent anecdotal evidence suggesting that women at high risk during pregnancy, so those who are actually recommended for bed rest for various pregnancy-related complications, there's been some reports, some editorials in the literature to suggest that it may be better for these women to avoid a complete sedentary state if recommended to bed rest, and that just mild interruptions in their sedentary time may be more helpful. And at this point, there's been no randomized trial looking at this, and it's really an untapped market, but they're right along with your thinking, suggesting that even in the highest risk cases, breaking up the sedentary time, definitely not physical activity, but just interrupting that sedentary time may be very important for decreasing risk of thromboembolism.
Well, yeah, so what would be an outcome or a risk that would result in a woman being confined to bed rest at the end of pregnancy? Like, what would be the sort of condition that would require that?
Yeah, that's it would be, to my knowledge, one of the maybe more clotting disorders or in terms
really?
Of
so,
cardio.
So someone who's at risk for a clotting disorder, they would tell them to go and be super sedentary as a means of... That seems like a horrible treatment.
I don't think that the clotting disorder per se would be the number one item on the clinical agenda at that point. There must be some other reason, maybe placenta accreta, which is where the placenta implants in a very abnormal way into the uterine wall. There's also
okay.
the placenta detaches from the uterine wall and to various degrees. And so in those instances, physical activity is completely inappropriate, and that's where the contraindications and the guidelines come into play. But
gotcha.
Yeah, no, it just it's that would more be a secondary outcome, but definitely something to be concerned about. And I know that speaking with Michelle Mottola, she's actually I don't know if it's rolled out yet, but they've proposed an idea to have a bed rest moderate or very, I guess it'd be mild physical activity intervention for women who are recommended to bed rest. So the thought process is out there, and they are aware of the ill effects of sedentary behavior in pregnancy.
That's very cool. And so one other question that Don wanted me to ask that I hadn't asked yet. Are there any sort of signs that a woman would know that she's exercising too much during pregnancy? You know, like, when you're not pregnant, things like, you know, if you're not menstruating would be a sign you might be exercising too much. What about during pregnancy? Like, are there any things, like, I guess if you're not gaining weight, it would seem like one. Are there anything that people could look for to as signs that they may be overdoing it?
Well, definitely, it's very important for active women to have an open dialogue with their care provider.
Yeah.
And really an honest dialogue. And if the provider's not initiating the conversation, then it has to be the woman who's initiating this dialogue, because it's really unique and very specific to each individual. There's no one rule. But my analogy would be to you would be very similar to overreaching or overtraining. Excessive fatigue, not wanting to get out, aches and pains, not getting any weight. And then, of course, the clinical parameters, where there may be abnormalities in the metabolic panels or sort of decelerated growth or abnormal growth trajectory as measured through ultrasound during the prenatal scans. So these are things that would be really aware of. But listening to your body, having an open dialogue with your clinician, seem to be what the consensus is in the literature in terms of catching that as early as possible.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. It's funny you mentioned overtraining, because it seems like every pregnant woman I've ever known seems like what I feel like when I'm overtrained. So, you know, just like you said, like, just tired and uncomfortable. And so that's kind of funny that would be something to look for.
I mean, if you're within the guidelines and you know you're making an effort to do what the guidelines suggest, and you are still experiencing these signs and symptoms, then I would definitely have a thorough conversation with your care provider as soon as possible.
That makes sense. And so last thing, do you want to talk at all about sort of things going forward, research questions you'd like to look at or are looking at or sort of would look at in an ideal world?
So, yeah, we've got a couple things on the go right now, and Kendra, who you know, Kendra Bradford, a peace student in the Halo Lab, is doing some very interesting stuff in her active mom study where she's looking at placental expression of certain transporters during pregnancy in moms who are self-reported highly active and moms who are self-reported more sedentary. And so there's going to be some really interesting stuff coming down the pipeline looking at physical activity and how this relates to nutrient transporters during pregnancy and then how those in turn relate to fetal growth outcomes. So she's doing big wide-scale placenta RNA arrays, and just today we discussed another project with the couple of fellows in the Apoptosis Center where we're going to do a whole exome-wide scan of the placenta in moms who exercise and compare it to those who don't exercise to see which proteins and which pathways are changing in active moms and non-active moms to try and corroborate some of the epi findings that are out there right now.
So kind of looking for the mechanism to try and explain what you see epidemiologically.
Exactly.
Cool. Well, is there anything else that you wanted to mention, Seth?
No, I think that's good. And what I'll do is maybe I'll provide you with a link to a very short piece that I wrote for the Canadian Sport Institute, where it focuses on physical activity recommendations for pregnant women. And they can they can read further into it if they like, and feel free to contact me via email or Twitter if anyone has any questions. I'd be happy to have a conversation anytime.
Absolutely. And what is, in case somebody doesn't see it on the blog, what is your Twitter handle? Is it just at Zach Ferraro?
At Dr. Ferraro, and I will give you that as well as the source, this very brief editorial that I wrote on the topic. So it's a quick read for the layperson. It was made for trainers of Olympians and people who are not familiar with exercise physiology to the degree that, say, you are. So, yeah, it's very user-friendly read, and hopefully it's useful to someone out there.
Great. I will put those all up. So so everyone, if you're hearing that, please visit the blog at blogs.class.org/obesitypanacea, or you can just Google obesity panacea and we'll put all those links up there. And so thanks a lot for joining me, Zach. That was great.
Thanks a lot, Travis, and give your best to Don for me.
Will do.